This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
.org. This has been the weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, where the time is almost 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Joe Clement, bringing you an hour of critical analysis and radical ideas for change. As Ursula Le Guin says in her novel, The Dispossessed, you can't crush ideas by suppressing them. You can only crush them by ignoring them, by refusing to think, refusing to change. Well, the old mole works to keep ideas for change alive so they cannot be ignored. On today's show, we'll be hearing about Quentin Tarantino's new shoot-'em-up black exploitation spaghetti western, Django Unchained. We'll hear a discussion of gun violence and the gun control debate, an exploration into what a sustainable economy in harmony with nature would be like, and a conversation about how differences and convergences between anarchism and Marxism play out in today's political movements. We'll also hear some music by some local performers. You can listen to this show or any part of it again or tell your friends about it. Just go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Well, today is Martin Luther King Day, as well as Inauguration Day, and much has been made of the connection between the inauguration of the nation's first black president on the day celebrating the national hero of the struggle for integration. But Glenn Ford, the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, says, "Don't you dare conflate MLK and Obama." And here is his argument. Shortly before his assassination in 1968, King said that he had, quote, come to believe we're integrating into a burning house, unquote. At least some African Americans have achieved deep penetration of the very pinnacles of white power structures, integrating the White House itself. Yet conditions of life for masses of black folks deteriorate and the society as a whole falls into deep decay. The fires lit by the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism that Dr. King identified in 1967 are consuming the world, now stoked by a black arsonist-in-chief. Domestic poverty hovers only a fraction of a percentage below the levels of 1965, with extreme poverty the highest on record. Black household wealth has collapsed to 1/20th that of whites. Today, more black men are under the control of the criminal justice system than were slaves in the decade before the Civil War. The intervening years have shown that Dr. King's 1960s vision of integration and economic justice were not in conflict. The rooms at the top floors of the National House may have been integrated, but the building still burns. The deepening crisis of capitalism, the triumph of Wall Street finance over industrial capital, the increasing imperial reversion to international lawlessness in a desperate bid to maintain global supremacy, all this was predictable under the laws of political economy. Had the assassin's bullet not found him, Dr. King would have continued his implacable resistance to these unfolding evils, rejecting Barack Obama's invasions, drones, and kill lists with the same moral fervor and political courage that he broke with Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. Absolutely nothing in King's life and work indicates otherwise. Surely the Dr. King, who called for a guaranteed annual income, would never have abided Obama's targeting of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in the weeks before his 2009 inauguration. 45 years ago, King's position was clear, quote, "Our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment or we must create incomes," unquote. The very notion of a grand austerity bargain with the right would have been anathema to MLK. Were Martin alive, he would skewer the putative leftists and their lesser evil rationales for backing the corporatist, warmongering Obama. MLK had no problem calling evil by its name. His militant approach to nonviolent, direct action required him to confront the underlying contradictions of society through the methodical application of creative tension. He would have made Wall Street scream, an attempt to render the nation ungovernable under the dictatorship of the lords of capital. And he would deliver a withering condemnation of the base corruption and self-serving that saturates the black misleadership class. He would spend his birthday preparing a massive disruptive action at the inauguration. And that's Glenn Ford writing in the Black Agenda Report. Now let's hear from today's movie moles, Joe Clement and Ivan Hale, as they review Quentin Tarantino's movie Django Unchained.
Good morning. This is Ivan Hale.
And Joe Clement.
And we're reviewing the very well-known, very highly reviewed movie Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino. Django Unchained is a movie about Django, played by Jamie Foxx, who is a slave being transported across Texas, is freed from his owners by Dr. King Schultz, played by Christoph Waltz, a German-born bounty hunter. Schultz has need of Django because the latter can recognize three brothers for whom the authorities are offering a large reward. In exchange for the slave's partnership in tracking down additional wanted men, Schultz will help Django rescue his wife, Brunhilde, played by Kerry Washington, from a Mississippi plantation owned by Calvin Candy, Leonardo DiCaprio. Complicated movie. What disturbs me the most is this idea that revenge is justice. And listening to people in the audience laughing and cheering when the quote, bad guys were killed, I find intensely disturbing and plays out, I think, in our society through things like the death penalty, through cheering at the death of Osama bin Laden, cheering at the death of Saddam Hussein. I mean, these are villains that we think, yeah, kill them, get them. And if we do, then everything's going to be okay. And that's just so not the reality. And I just find that to be a really shallow kind of path. But then this is the movies, right? This is what entertainment is. And is this what Americans like? I don't know.
Yeah, I like what Anthony Lane, writing for The New Yorker, had written in a very short review of the film. He says that Tarantino is dangerously in love with the look of evil, and all he can counter it with is cool, not strength of purpose, let alone goodness of heart, but simple comeuppance issued with merciless panache. And there's a reason that the film is supposed to be exciting on this level, and I just don't think I actually like it. It's playing with very strong emotions that run deep in this country, and it's frivolous with them in a way that I think shows disrespect, and not just on the level of historical accuracy, because there are plenty of people out there saying, you know, this is devoid of X, Y, and Z objective fact of slavery that is due recognition. But on the level of the story that it's actually trying to tell, it eviscerates the feeling of freedom that should come with being liberated.
I listened to an interview with Quentin Tarantino by Terry Gross on NPR, and he said that what he was going for, that he feels that he would have failed in his objective with the movie if people didn't cheer when Candyland was burned to the ground and when white slavers were killed, that if people didn't cheer, that he had done something wrong, and that that's what he was going for, was people to cheer the death of the oppressor. I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, well, they substitute the death of the oppressor for the death of oppression, because Django is running through this film with his relatively single-minded mission, mm-hmm. which is actually routed through a German mm-hmm. myth. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of interesting things about this film, and this is one of them, or it's one that draws you in because it seems very thought out with a particular kind of message, and that message is at home in an age of neoliberal deregulation, and as well as the revitalization of anarchist organizing in the United States as being something that people talk about, and that it's playing with this sense of people have to take things into their own hands, but it does so in a reactionary way. Django isn't out to free anyone else but his wife, although he does, you know, happen to help people on the way. He's not burdened by the cause of abolition. And I think that is the hard thing in this film is what to do with that. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, it's, you know, trying to determine what the oppressed person values. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it's putting it on display to ask hard questions about what is the meaning of this freedom if it's just for yourself.
Yeah, that is very true, in that Django, when given the opportunity, the scene where he is being taken to the mining company against his will, of course, and he's in a cage with three other slaves, when Django does escape and ends up killing all the people who are taking him en route to his doom in the mining camp, I wanted him to join forces with the three men in the cave and free them and say, come on, let's go, you know, burn down this Candyland place or whatever. But he didn't. He just looks at them and kind of rides away. And then there's that close-up of the man, the slave man in the carriage, whereby he gives this kind of little smile like, yeah, go get him, Django. You're a real tough guy. You know, and I found myself thinking, oh, is that smile, does that mean he sees the seeds of freedom in Django and his taking on the master as, well, if he can do that, I can do that too. And is that little smile the formings of his own roots of liberation? I wanted to think that. But yes, this movie is very much about Django freeing the princess, as is in the German epic Brunhilde, who is surrounded by fire and is being held by a dragon until the prince Siegfried comes to save her in the German myth. And this is the same thing we have going on here, whereas Django is Siegfried and he's saving Brunhilde, not from a dragon on a mountain, but from a evil plantation owner.
Yeah, and Kerry Washington actually looks at the scrutiny over the role because she is a very undeveloped damsel. We know that she's intellectually capable and apparently very beautiful. But she says that, look, I can see how it's not particularly feminist to play the princess in the tower, waiting to be saved. But as a black woman, we've never been afforded that luxury. In some ways, this telling is a statement of empowerment. Some people have put it in terms of it's saying that black women are actually worth, you know, fighting for, worth killing for, worth, you know, climbing over dead bodies for. But I think it's worth asking why maybe that particular kind of story hasn't typically featured black people. And it may not be because they aren't as represented so much as it's a story that white people told to tell white people.
Right.
It's an ancient German epic.
Right.
And it reverberates in our culture, but it reverberates along white lines.
Right. I'm kind of reaching here maybe, but along class lines too, because isn't it the prince who saves the damsel in distress? It's not the peasant who goes off to save, you know, his sister or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, it's, or his ox or whatever, who's been taken by a slaughterhouse or something. It's wealthy royalty going off to save wealthy royalty. And the fact that here we have a freed slave, an oppressed person going off to save another oppressed person. So that's a very much a twist on the idea.
Yeah, though he's wrangled into this position and offered his freedom by a man who says that he despises slavery but is willing to use it to his ends in as long as the institution persists. And so there's this dubiousness or diabolicalness to the relationship that he establishes with Schultz, who's very amicable. He doesn't try to control him. He doesn't try to tell him what to do. They're both very individual respecting men, mm-hmm. and they're bounty hunters, they're mercenaries. There is, you know, a class dimension to this relationship that needs to be seen in reflection of the much more kind of indulgent, vaguely French influenced, and therefore suggested of the Ancien Régime, Calvin Candy and his Uncle Tom head house slave,
played by Samuel Jackson.
Yes, quite vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
The Django Schultz characters are basically part business partners, mm-hmm. and there's an implication that freedom for black people was to be found in capitalism or mm-hmm. in some idea of contractual exchange.
Mm-hmm.
But that is all still embedded within the capitalist slave-owning system that Django has no interest in affronting.
Mm-hmm. There's another point, too, in the Brunhild concept, in that Kerry Washington is really – Brunhild is a concept. She's not a person, per se. She's an idea, and an idea of a captured princess. And to say that that is empowering to women, well, no. You know, I did not see that. I did not see Brunhild's character or Kerry Washington's character. I was not – uplifted by this. I did not feel that was empowering to women in the slightest. And the most lines she says are the German lines. And then she does many, many expressions with her face that she was brilliant at expressing her emotions through her face. But again, she is a concept. She's not actually a character. She's an idea.
Yeah, other reviewers kind of responded to this, such as Janelle Hobson writing for Ms. Magazine, who kind of points out that it's not that believable strong women characters aren't possible. They're all over the place, and in particular in these kind of fairy tale stories with the new reimagining of the Snow White story, Snow White and the Huntsman, or Pixar's strong princess story, Brave. It just wouldn't have been that hard to make Brunhilde a believable participant in her own liberation.
Django's character refers to her a couple of times as the troublemaker, and we're to understand that she's tried to escape from Candyland twice. We see the whip scars on her backs from several beatings, giving us the impression that she has instigated trouble and had to be put down forcibly over and over again from the owners, from the masters. But we don't see any of that. We hear about it, and he calls her his little troublemaker, but we don't see any of that happening. We just kind of understand that to be true because she certainly has no agency in her own escape from Candyland.
No, and a lot of the slaves are very zombie-like, and
mm-hmm. Yes, I noticed.
It's hard to say whether that is really accurate or not, but there is a way in which it felt like only certain characters were allowed to actually have personalities, whereas the mass of people were unbelievable pawns.
Mm-hmm. So Quentin Tarantino has certainly taken a genre and turned it on its head, for sure. Taken spaghetti western, blaxploitation, and revenge film and turned it into this
And German
thing.
Epic.
German epic, right. Yeah, and turned it into this thing and definitely turned gotten us all thinking hard about many different things. I mean, I've read a ton of reviews and they almost all say very different things and have very different things to say. And some seem like people who like Quentin Tarantino like the movie. People who don't like Quentin Tarantino didn't like the movie. And then there were also, of course, many who had very intelligent things to say, regardless of their opinion of Quentin Tarantino or his movies. To say, however, that this movie is revolutionizing film or empowering African Americans to this new level, I completely disagree with.
This has been Joe Clement and Ivan Hale. We've been talking about Quentin Tarantino's new shoot 'em up blaxploitation spaghetti western, Django Unchained, for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you.
Let it know.
And that's Let Your Voice Be Heard, a track inspired by Martin Luther King by Pointed Man Band, consisting of Portland musician Dan Elliott. We'll link to his website on the webpage for today's show. And just before that, we heard Ivan Hale and Joe Clement reviewing Django Unchained. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Next up is a conversation between Old Mole's Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken about gun violence, gun control, and mental health, and about the conversation going on in the political mainstream.
The school massacre in an elementary school in Newtown, Massachusetts, has reignited the gun control debate and how to best protect against gun violence. Last week, the president made his proposals, offered his plan, and the National Rifle Association promoted its ideas. Jan Hocken and I, Bill Resnick of the Old Mole Collective, find both sets of proposals very deficient, and the NRA's and other radical right plans very dangerous. So, John, why don't we just summarize the two plans? You can do the Obama plan. I'll talk about the right wings.
Well, the Obama plan may be a way of keeping the issue of gun control politically alive because it has a history of fading quite quickly after these highly sensationalized cases fade. But it includes a mix of reasonable initiatives, public health education on gun safety, reinstating the assault weapons ban, certainly a good thing, tightening background checks, more research on gun violence, of course, and more funds to law enforcement. Some of the more controversial initiatives among progressives involves this increased focus on mental health professionals reporting people at risk for violence, perhaps in adding to what therapists already have under the law as a duty to warn for people who are potential threat to others, and also the initiatives that involve school safety officers working with local police.
Right. In the list, you somehow added more resources for law enforcement. The good parts of it are more enforcement of the existing laws and, in fact, tightening the existing laws and removing all of the limitations on gun law enforcement that the NRA has put into congressional mandates of one kind or another. It seems to me we just don't want to pour more money just into police forces, obviously, or into school safety officers.
Yeah, I think there are some areas where the NRA and the gun control advocates meet around mental health issues that is also worrisome.
Right.
The focus on identifying people who are mentally ill or dangerous and putting a lot of weight on the promise that there will be a network of therapists out there to catch these young people, primarily young men who are very angry and seeking one way of achieving recognition, even through a violent death of others and themselves. And it's very difficult to have a conversation about why people do this because, I mean, for one thing, it's not very common. That's important to emphasize. And it's very difficult to talk about the perpetrators without demonizing them and casting them into a category that's so outside of the human experience in general. And I think this happens among feminists dealing with the anti-violence issues as well as conservatives.
Let's get back to that, to the big picture of dealing with gun violence and public safety and how it's being used. Let me do the right-wing response, which is truly terrible and unfortunately gaining ground. An important part of it is, of course, the NRA, and they keep reiterating it. It's almost comic, but nobody laughs. And so many people support it, this notion that the route to public safety is to arm everybody, every home with a gun, every school with armed guards of one kind or another. The NRA is proposing that, in fact, these be volunteers, that is, good guys who will have guns to stop the bad guys, and have them in every school, these volunteers, and sort of organized into vigilante groups. Sheriff Joe Arapio in Phoenix, who has created his own private militia of private citizens who are armed and buy their own uniforms and weapons, supported by business interests in Phoenix, they began just harassing Latino people in their neighborhoods. They now, although, after the Newtown shootings, the massacre, have added to their repertory, and they are now patrolling around schools with support from the police, of course, in the sheriff's department in Phoenix. That, of course, has given upstanding white men a cause in life, but it's really a recipe for right-wing vigilantism. That seems to me the sort of part of the driving purpose of the NRA is to create this sense of both fear of violence and the need for guns and the use of guns and the creation of an ever-expanding block of people who see sort of weapons and law enforcement and getting the bad guys as the way to make their lives secure.
Part of what you're describing is this dilemma in countering the NRA and this, what many people recognize as an unwholesome obsession with guns in the U.S. I mean, I'm just off the charts, the number of weapons, firearms owned by people in the United States is something like 89 for every 100 persons, over 300 million guns in the U.S. And, of course, most of the households who own guns have a number of them. But I think it's very difficult to talk about what is this about. Is there some fetishizing of the guns on both sides where the NRA hold fiercely to this right, but then in opposing it, do we also run the risk of arming the opposition and fueling the very problem we're trying to confront?
Yeah, there are countries where a very large majority of the people own guns, like Norway or Canada, and there are almost no gun deaths. There are some, but it's
but
far,
firearm
far
ownership in the U.S. it so outreaches any other country in the world, and particularly these assault weapons. That's very different than a hunting rifle.
Well,
so there are guns and guns. And then there are communities I think we need to look at what some of the demographics are around attachments to gun ownership. The NRA is this very big banner that claims to speak for every American in defending this, you know, the Second Amendment. But there are communities throughout the country where people within the illicit economies depend on weapons because they cannot look to the police and are very paranoid about the police. Then there are other very conservative vigilante groups that have a historical hostility toward the government and also toward the emergence of rights of minorities. You know, they feel threatened by the diminishing entitlements of white men as they're perceived to be diminishing. So I think it's very difficult to address some of the anxieties, both rational and irrational, driving this issue.
This is KABU Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're talking about and comparing the plans of the Obama administration on the one hand and the NRA, finding both really deficient. We'll conclude the interview, not though right now, with a discussion of how should we understand gun violence and particularly how do we see the socioeconomic contexts, which are not discussed at all. Jan, why don't we first go into the mental health stuff, which is, it seems to me, highly questionable whether it would work and whether it's attractive and whether it will have any of the impacts that the Obama administration thinks it will have.
I'm very nervous about proposals advancing a mental health system and reforming the mental health system through the gun control issue. It's an irrational and worrisome basis for expanding mental health services. First, prediction of violence is notoriously difficult. The best and most reliable predictor of violence is a history of violence, and those who work in the field of risk assessment will tell you the predictors are not very good. And most of the high-profile cases, there are a few that have come under the eye of the mental health system, but most of these guys don't see a therapist anyway. I think one effect is just to make therapists nervous and everybody more vigilant, which isn't a particular effective response. Most therapists are going to ignore the nuances of this shift. There have been laws in place since the 70s around some of this duty to inform or warn, but a lot of it just makes people jumpy and doesn't really achieve much. And certainly most people who have diagnosable mental condition are more apt to be victims of others than perpetrators, at any rate.
Now, another critique of the mental health system as it exists today is that in many ways it's been folded into the drug industry and is sort of the drug industry is really dominating the way people are treated. And so even troubled people, the few who did become mass killers who have had some contact, their contact was relatively brief. They were given drugs.
Some of which can increase the risk of unpredictable behavior among young people.
And even if they worked to some extent to slow them down and to, quote, drug them, the people generally stop taking them and become even more troubled and give up on any sort of help. Just expanding the system as it exists now seems to me a terrible idea, actually.
Well, the mental health system includes a lot. It's now been pretty much taken over by the pharmaceutical companies, but there are many school counselors and community clinics that are useful and have been dismantled over the last few decades, and that it would be a good thing to have these crisis intervention services in the community, more street front clinics, places where people can go where they're feeling upset. Most of those are not run by psychiatrists, but counselors and therapists who have lost ground over the last few decades. But I think to have them as an arm of the police is a bad idea, just as I think it's been costly for the anti-violence movement to work so closely with the police, hand in glove, in dealing with issues of family violence. A topic perhaps for another day.
There are so many topics, and we're going to have to conclude. And I think the conclusion has to be a discussion very briefly and sort of schematically about what really could be done. There's a lot of things. This society creates a lot of empty, lost, vengeful young men who ultimately get into one or another kind of suicidal behavior, often taking a lot of other people with them as part of their vengeance fantasy. Jan, how do we understand the really deep problems that a lot of particularly young men have in this society, and why does it move towards now this sort of murderous suicidal vengeance?
Well, alongside that trend is, I think, also a hopeful trend in this country away from interpersonal violence and more people aware of bullying. I remember when I was growing up, date rape or bullying were just, those were things you had to put up with and you did not make a fuss about it. And so overall, I think there is less tolerance for interpersonal violence in this country and a worry and a well-founded worry that there are problems on a broader societal level that this issue is tapping into. And so I think there may be more thoughtful local conversations about how to not just demonize these outliers, but to create more places where people feel kind of held and recognized in their communities and are less likely to act out.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's been a change in the way that people deal interpersonally with one another. Dramatic, really good changes. On the other side, there have also been changes where young white men have, a lot of them have no futures, but are told, if you're determined and smart, you can go anywhere in America. Well, so many of them are undermined by the combination of it. Secondly, there's what I call the rot from the top, that is the enormous amount of predation without criminal prosecution of not just bankers, but most of the elite. Partly it's legal predation because they can change the rules of the game to benefit themselves. And secondly, there's the empire building, the U.S. as the aggressive imperial force and relying on weapons and ever advancing weapons and weaponry and warfare when necessary to reach its ends. So we have drones and torture, all those things, it seems to me, are
in
quite
a very militarized country, right, militaristic country.
Right, and they're very degrading, and especially for the young men who get into that and who are lured, in fact, into those occupations because there's nothing else for them. It seems to me we at least have to think about that. We have to develop the social context of that, as well as just the declining fortunes of those young men who are, many of them are downwardly mobile. They're never going to live as well as their parents, and they know it, and will not be able to raise a family. It seems to me there's very few outlets for them. So there's a lot of really, I think, troubled young people around, even if few of them, in fact, get into this murderous violence. And you can conclude, Jen.
I think that if I were to pick a campaign, I'd pick the gun control issue and perhaps community mental health over, for example, cracking down on the entertainment business, even though the level of violence in films and entertainment in this country provides much fuel for the fantasy lives of these alienated young men. But often there the crackdown tends to be on those very communities of angry young people in the margins who produce some angry music. And so we have to tread lightly on where we go with our campaigns and that they can misfire. But building communities where people feel more secure in general, and reducing inequality in general is a good thing. Most important worldwide predictor of violence is income inequality.
Yeah.
And so these are, I think, important grounds to build on.
Yeah, without having a society that creates jobs so that young men can see themselves having a future and having dignified, honorable roles, you're going to have a huge amount of violence. And all the mental health counselors in the world and even gun control regulations are not going to work. Jan, well, it was good talking to you again. That's Jan Hocken and I, Old Mole, part of the Old Mole Collectives, talking about how to reduce gun violence and murderous gun violence and human troubles.
Thank you.
Now, a whole lot of things been bothering me. Because a lot of people think that things is cool. People ride around in those cars and riding them airplanes. Pocket full of money and everybody thinks that things is cool. Even old jive president accident, would make you think that things is cool. But I'm here to tell all y'all and him too, that we got a cross that we must bear. And the cross gets awful heavy. Now there's the black cross, the green cross, the white cross, the double cross, the crisscross, and the lost cross. And the cross gets awful heavy, different times. But one is supposed to keep on going on and carrying the cross on his shoulder. Because you ain't supposed to let no cross you up. You're supposed to let a cross help you get across. And if you let a cross help you get across, you won't get crossed up, but you'll be on the cross because you done got a cross on the cross. So if you can remember this, you won't get lost on the cross while you're trying to get across. So we just here to let you know about it. I know that you knew already, because y'all the hippest people in the world. Hip, black, and white. But you still know that you got a cross you must deal with. So when it crosses you up, go on and deal with it. And leave it alone.
And that's Rahsaan Roland Kirk in a live performance of The Old Rugged Cross. And just before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken talking about the debate on gun violence, gun control, and mental health. If you want to hear that conversation again, check out our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in a day or two. This is KBOO and the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Clayton Morgridge. Now, here's Tom Becker reading a piece by David Corton asking, what would a down-to-earth economy look like? Tom.
Good morning. It is self-evident that human activity is gradually destroying our planet and that ever-continuing economic growth and rising standards of living in industrialized and industrializing nations is not sustainable. Even left-leaning economists such as Thomas Friedman still preach the mantra of continuing economic growth. At present, it seems unlikely that such goals will be abandoned until it's too late and the system collapses from its own excesses and we come to realize that we humans are part of nature and bounded by its irrevocable laws. Today, I'm going to share with you an excerpt from an article that attempts to envision a sustainable economy that is in harmony with nature. The article is entitled, What Would a Down-to-Earth Economy Look Like? By David Corton. David Corton is the author of Agenda for a New Economy, The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, and the international bestseller, When Corporations Rule the World. With proper care and respect, Corton begins, Earth can provide a high quality of life for all people in perpetuity. Yet we devastate productive lands and waters for quick profit, a few temporary jobs, or a one-time resource fix. Our current expansion of tar sands oil extraction, deep-sea oil drilling, hydraulic fracturing natural gas extraction, and mountaintop removal coal mining are but examples of this insanity. These highly profitable choices deepen our economic dependence on rapidly diminishing non-renewable fossil energy reserves, disrupt the generative capacity of Earth's living systems, and accelerate climate disruption. A global economy dependent on this nonsense is already failing, and its ultimate collapse is only a matter of time. For a surprising long time, we humans have successfully maintained the illusion that we are outside, superior to, and not subject to the rules of nature. We do so, however, at huge cost, and payment is coming due. To secure the health and happiness of future generations, we must embrace life as our defining value, recognizing that competition is but a subtext of life's deeper narrative of cooperation, and restructure our institution to conform to life's favored organizing principle of radically decentralized, localized decision-making and self-organization. Modern neuroscience affirms that the human brain evolved to reward cooperation. In other words, nature has hardwired these instructions into our brain. Extreme individualism, greed, and violence are pathological and a sign of physical, developmental, cultural, or industrial system failure. So what would nature design? What would an economy designed by nature look like? Earth's exquisitely complex, resilient, and continuously evolving band of life, the biosphere, demonstrates on a grand scale the creative potential of the distributed intelligence of many trillions of individual self-organizing, choice-making living organisms. Acting in concert, they continuously regenerate soils, rivers, aquifers, fisheries, forests, and grasslands while maintaining climatic balance and the composition of the atmosphere to serve the needs of Earth's widely varied life forms. If nature were in charge of creating an Adirne economy, she would surely apply the same principles she applies in natural systems. Her goal would be a global system of bioregional living economies that secure a healthy, happy, and productive life for every person on the planet in symbiotic balance with the non-human systems on which we humans depend for breathable air, drinkable water, fertile soils, timber, fish, grasslands, and climate stability. Each bioregional economy would meet its own needs for energy, water, nutrients, and mineral resources through sustained local capture, circular flow, utilization, and repurposing. Decision-making would be local, and the system would organize from the bottom up. Diversity and redundancy would support local adaptation and resilience. This should be our goal and vision. With the biosphere as our system's model, we would design our economic institution and rules to align with nature's rules and organizing principles. We'd replace GDP as a primary measure of economic performance with a new system of living system indicators that assess economic performance against the outcomes we actually want, healthy, happy people, and healthy, resilient natural systems. We would redirect the time, talent, and money we currently devote to the growing GDP, material consumption, securities bubbles, and Wall Street bonuses to producing the outcomes we really want. We would favor local cooperative ownership and control, organizing from the bottom up in support of bioregional self-reliance. Our economic institutions would support local decision-making in response to local needs and opportunities. Cultural and biological diversity and sharing within and between local communities would support local and global resilience and facilitate life-serving systems innovation. The result would be an economy that conforms to the organizing principles of nature, real markets, and true democracy. The challenge is epic in its proportions and long overdue. We are Earth's children. We must honor and care for her. Together we can forge an integral partnership grounded in the learning and deep wisdom of our 3.8 billion year experience in nurturing life expanding capacities for intelligent self-organizing creative innovation and self-reflective consciousness. That was an essay by David Corton, the author of the international bestseller with When Corporations Rule the World. The complete article can be found by Googling its title, What Would a Down-to-Earth Economy Look Like? The future, by necessity, will correspond in many ways to Corton's vision of localized economies. The question is, are we going to get there by a crash landing with disastrous consequences or a purposeful change of course before it really is too late? This is Tom Becker for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Tom. Well, coming up soon on KBOO at 10, it's Air Cascadia with locally produced news, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today, we'll take a look at British Petroleum and the company's history of non-compliance with federal environmental regulations. Our guest is reporter Abram Lustgarten, who has been following BP's past and present crimes against the environment for ProPublica. And starting at 11, we'll have special programming for most of the day. KBOO will go live to the New Beginnings Conference Center for live coverage of Keep Alive the Dream, Portland's annual tribute to the life and work of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Well, last week on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick and Brian Palmer discussed the relations between anarchism and Marxism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, sometimes conflictual, sometimes cooperative. In part two of that interview, they consider how today's political movements, including Occupy, continue to draw on both traditions. Here's Bill.
Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Talking to Brian Palmer, we've been talking about the both cooperation amongst Marxists and anarchists in the early years in the 19th century, the late 19th century, common aims, mutual struggles, sometimes some sorts of tactical conflicts. That, in fact, gave way ultimately the Marxists and, well, communists and anarchists came into severe conflict, and it became extremely difficult to work together during the period of Russian hegemony over the revolutionary left and the way the Russians dealt with the anarchist forces in the Spanish Civil War and the anarchists in Russia made any kind of cooperation impossible. Let's talk about the current period, Brian Palmer. You know the Occupy movement, looked at it in the United States and Canada, and there are so many struggles now that share those common goals. In fact, don't even differ a great deal on strategy. There seems to me now that 19th century sort of ideals and common struggle are now occurring again. Why don't you go into it in the kind of detail it deserves?
Yeah. Well, I was heartened by the breakout of the Occupy movement, the way in which it really galvanized a great deal of popular resentment toward the 1% was their term. And I think there was, you know, what we were seeing was a kind of effervescent outpouring of the resentments and grievances that had been pent up for years and that had come to a head with the fiscal crisis and financial meltdown of 2007 to 2009, and the way in which that revealed the blatant hypocrisy of the political order, which for 20 years all we'd been hearing from the time of Reagan was how the market was sacrosanct and how we had to get government out of all kinds of areas of essentially helping people who needed some help, the dismantling of the welfare state and a whole series of other sort of retrograde moves. And then the minute that the large financial corporations, which had created this immense problem, the minute that they are exposed and their stocks are plummeting, their economic house is all of a sudden collapsing.
Well, in effect, in bankruptcy, most of these companies.
Yeah, the minute that that happens, then all of a sudden, all this market ideology and the necessity of keeping the government out and not bailing out people in need, letting them pull themselves up by their bootstraps, all that went out the window, and the state, of course, had to bail out the very large financial interests. Well, millions of individual small property owners suffered immensely. And, of course, where millions of workers were thrown out of jobs because plants were closing, etc. So the Occupy movement was a kind of breakout and a demand, a set of demands that was meant to strike back at this. I think many of the people involved in Occupy, particularly young people, probably saw themselves as more on the anarchist side of the dissident opposition than on the Marxist side. But many of them also had some of that bridging capacity that had been part of Marxism and anarchism's origins. And I think what was a fundamental necessity of that moment was to, and we're still in it, is to basically educate people again, in the sort of common struggles, common perspectives, and the richness of both of these traditions, both of which have strengths and both of which have weaknesses, by which I mean anarchism and Marxism. And I really think that, you know, what probably needs to be done is for the forces in Occupy to, as they're fighting the fight, to simultaneously kind of educate themselves anew in the strengths of Marxism and the strengths of anarchism, and to come up with new ways of broadening the collective struggle against the ways in which capitalism is sort of debasing life for the masses of people in modern society.
Let me state a hypothesis that with the collapse of Stalinism and also the disintegration of the social democratic parties into efforts to somehow better manage capitalism, and now they're not even there in Europe. They're all the big parties are cooperating in austerity against the working class. It seems to me that with some of the great institutions of left struggle in the late 20th centuries having been effectively defeated, there's now a recognition on the left and amongst broad sectors that the struggle has to be done differently, and that, in fact, democracy and creating institutions of democratic participation and building workers, various kinds of workers and poor people's and women's movement organization, there has to be a coalition and community efforts and local agriculture efforts and all of the others. Now it's becoming clear that that's going to have to be the, and of course of the racial minorities, there's going to have to be some sort of grand, I don't know, consolidation, coalition, not wiping out the particularities, but working together. That has to be united in a democratic front and a very participatory one. It's not some kind of institution run by some grand coalition run from the top and taking orders, but it's a sort of a working relationship on a local level of democracy, respect for one another, some kinds of mutual decision-making. It gets complicated, the processes of decision-making. It seems to me that's now becoming more and more clear. You see much of the left moving in that direction, and the Occupy movement as an expression of that. At least that's my hypothesis. What's your sense?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that, but what I would stress is the necessity in this process of sort of recreation and renewal that we not simply jettison everything in the past. There is in our past tremendous resources, a tremendous body of resources that are associated with the anarchist and Marxist traditions. For instance, I think that what the Marxist tradition has brought very much to the table that the anarchist tradition has not is the necessity of actual organizations, structures, parties, if you will.
Labor unions, yeah. Labor movement, and organized labor and real structures of power and institutionalized is fundamental, even though they've become corrupted at this point.
I think that the struggle is simultaneously to defend and extend old gains, old accomplishments, and to infuse them with new insights, fresh perspectives, and advanced understandings related to our own period. And that's the kind of dialectic, if you will, to realize that we have to move forward, we have to change, but that we can only do so on the basis of an actual understanding of the balance sheet of the past, which is a very mixed balance sheet, but that we cannot be reinventing the wheel at every stage of the kind of struggle. It simply will set us back too much. And in that sense, the project in both Marxist and anarchist terms has always been one of educating masses of people to see the kind of realities that they live within, but also to see the necessity of struggling to challenge those realities, to transform them. And a part of that educational process is really knowing the traditions of dissent and mobilization and opposition, understanding the institutions that have been created, often from below, on the part of workers, others, students, poor people that have effectively challenged and sometimes fought back against the oppressions and exploitations of our times. So That's a critical point, and it involves not just living in our moment, but understanding that our moment is the culmination of past moments, and understanding that in that process of culmination, there are deep reservoirs and legacies of resistance that we can learn from and that we can refine. My understanding of Occupy is really that the advance guard, if you will, of Occupy was really the West Coast. I mean, I know less about Portland than I do about San Francisco, but I think, you know, there was very close connections that were developed among, for instance, dissidents and left-wing elements in the Longshoremen's Union and in the Occupy movement. That had I think, a salutary effect on Occupy, because it pushed the notion of general strikes, of democratically organized opposition movements, even within the trade unions. And it pushed things forward, I think, in very positive and productive ways.
Brian Palmer, thanks so much. We really do have to examine our history. Brian Palmer is a wonderful historian. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Right. So long.
We're going to keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward. Oh, keep on walking forward. Never turning back. Never turning back. We're going to keep on walking proudly. Keep on walking proudly.
And that was Satori Men's Chorus singing Never Turning Back by Pat Humphreys at Artichoke Music's celebration of Martin Luther King last Saturday night at the Artichoke Cafe. Well, that's all from the Old Mole this week. Many thanks to Joe Clement and Ivan Hale for their review of Django Unchained, to Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken for their probing conversation about gun violence, and to Brian Palmer and Bill Resnick for their discussion of anarchism and Marxism. Well, if you want to hear this show again or any part of it, I would say visit our website, but there's been some problems with the KBOO website of late, and so we're going to have to ask you instead to email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. That's all one word, oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com, and request a segment of the show or the show as a whole, and we can put you in touch with it. Well, so tune in next Monday morning at 9 o'clock for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Old Mole's Underground Perspective. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Joe Clement is our engineer.
KBOO Radio is a proud media sponsor of the 28th annual Martin Luther King Day event. Keep Alive the Dream, an annual tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., produced by the World Arts Foundation. This year's event will take place at the New Beginnings Conference Center, 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in Portland. KBOO will again broadcast the annual celebration in its entirety. More information about this live broadcast can be found at kboo.fm/2013MLK.
This Wednesday, January 23rd, KBOO will broadcast live from downtown Portland, where the Illihi Lecture Series kicks off its 2013 lecture series, Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. With award-winning author, activist, and food policy expert Raj Patel speaking on Who Owns Our Food.
In every food riot that has happened, you've seen a demand for food linked to a demand for political change.
That's 7 this Wednesday, January 23rd. For tickets to the talk, go to illihi.org or listen live on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, January 21st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the